Very good morning. Thank you for joining us here at the UN office at Geneva for this press briefing today, Tuesday, the 18th of November. We have, as usual, a very busy and important agenda for you. On my right, Patrick Youssef, who is ICRC's Africa Regional Director. Very pleased to have him join us here. He's going to speak to two subjects, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, as well as Sudan. We have Ricardo in the room from UNICEF, who's going to address the situation in Gaza, as well as a colleague joining from the World Food Program in Rome, who's going to speak to the global outlook on food security needs, which was the subject at a Security Council meeting yesterday. In fact, we also have colleagues from the Global Fund who are going to deliver an announcement. So without further ado, Patrick, over to you for updates on DRC and then Sudan.
Thank you so much, and good morning to you all. And thanks again for your continuous interest on the DRC. I just came back from a mission to the east of DRC, to Goma specifically, after having spent a few days in Kinshasa, but also in Kigali before getting into Goma, in order to follow up on the situation, to engage as much as possible with the authorities, but also make sure we understand the current situation and the evolving situation of the civilian population since the onset of this crisis. While some form of life or some commerce, for example, has resumed in Goma, the situation in the north and south Kivu remains extremely difficult. The people we talked to on the ground and the families I met alongside the Croix Rouge de la RDC, the Red Cross of the DRC, showed indeed extreme difficulties to cope with the economic situation, with the rising prices, and again with the unavailability of the basic needs that any family would require. We see, and we've spoken last time about the double vulnerability of the civilian population and the dual crisis people are living, and very fortunate to have seen and witnessed what that means actually on the ground. When we speak about a protection crisis, a crisis of respect for international humanitarian law and the basic principles of the Geneva Convention's human rights law, but also the normal customary traditions that have governed this country for decades, one can see that there are still medical needs. There are a lot of hostilities away from Goma, but still very close in Beni, but there's also a context where, and unfortunately that's my message today, it is very underfunded. With all the attention that we've seen in Paris at the Paris conference, which I took part in, and we heard a lot of the pledges, quite generous pledges on the context, we have to say that we're still very much underfunded, and as much as the whole humanitarian community is trying its best to be next to the civilian population, we need to underline that in a global contraction for finances for humanitarian action, DRC should be in a way the exception, like all these front lines, open front lines, evolving into the images that you see, from violent acts to attacks to the civilian population. Sexual violence has been already a significant concern in terms of protection, and that has unfortunately increased dramatically in light of the recent escalation of the conflict. We do observe also civilians that are still paying the heavy price, be that those who we see, but also those off the grid, those meaning in places of detention or in camps quite away from public eyes. And therefore, we see, like in the Kivus, nearly 70% of the weapon wounded that are treated in the different centers led by the ICRC and the relevant ministries are civilians. I visited the hospital in Dosho inside Goma, which with our full surgical team, and that keeps on being strengthened by more human resources, we see a number of civilians. And I met with a wider family that had three of its sons under surgery because of the because of the hostilities, and that's unfortunately something we see on the increase. When we say 70% of the weapon wounded, that's the study that we've conducted and the statistics we have from January to September, and you can imagine, and the flare up up of, 20, of October 2025, these numbers are increasing. Now, as I said, the sexual violence, which was already a significant concern, we see, again, according to our assessments, that and we visited une maison d'écoute, so that's a center that is run by the local Red Cross, by the branch of Goma. And we see, unfortunately, that out of from January to June 2025, nearly 22,800 victims of violence, including sexual violence, needed psychological support. And I'm sure that's only the tip of the iceberg. We're talking about 22,000 people only in the last 9 months. And those were the courageous ones that have approached centers or the local Red Cross to put their heavyweight on someone else's shoulder and try and seek some form of support. Again, I just mentioned those two because they go at the heart of every family, but they also are part of the destruction of the social cohesion communities and tribes and people have to have, even in the worst of times, especially in the current situation. But then we can indeed go into other forms of atrocities that we're witnessing, and we're indeed in a very long process, but steady process, of bringing these vulnerabilities to the attention of the commanders on the local local and federal commander, and global commanders on the ground, and that indeed puts us in a different situation when it comes to the protection of civilians, which shouldn't just be a mean for us to talk on publicly in front of journalists, but to be subject of referrals and interventions made in confidentiality with all the parties to indeed improve the situation of those we see, but also those under arrest, for example. And let me say that our call here is, first and foremost, we have seen a strong commitment, we're witnessing a strong commitment by the parties to respect international law, as we have seen now in the recent signature of the Framework for Peace in Doha, which we salute, and certainly would, like every human being today, wants to see an end to the hostilities. But these frameworks are still theoretical. We really need a way to see how a ceasefire would be implemented and how indeed the delivery of aid can be expanded and surged. A recent study by the ICRC in September shows that 85% of the hospitals have no medicines anymore, and I think we've portrayed that in several news releases. But that is not just a figure. That means there is a disruption into how much a hospital or its staff can stand in front of a family and say, I, medical personnel, I'm unable to support you because I have no means. And hence our public call was even to act as a neutral intermediary to facilitate the delivery of medicines to the center that we support. While we are able to get surgical material, it's impossible to get to millions and millions of people the medical needs they need, or indeed the attention on the difficult cases like hemodialysis or other diseases that could be cured. And here we're not talking of a context where Ebola has resumed or where there are other pockets that require that much attention. And when it happens, as in Sudan, when we witnessed a big cholera outbreak, that's unfortunately when we won't be able to respond. And that's what we need to avoid in an area that still has some functional medical capacities. Now, that's on the protection side. And allow me just one word on the structural side of things. The ICRC, with a number, a coalition of partners, managed to bring a full water network in West Goma, and we're working on the northern part now, to deliver water in a safe way, including at the peak of the crisis, where we're very cognizant of the fact that more of the development actors require these de-risking opportunities for them to be functional. And here, like we did in Paris, we still call on and a specific intention on the critical infrastructure, meaning access to water, access to healthcare, and indeed all the other forms of support that is required for the population to remain hopeful. Now, I have to say again, acknowledging the progress in Washington and in Doha, we remain very present on the ground. We're with a big, strong team of over 350 colleagues between Beni and Goma. We also have a strong presence in Bunia, in Bukavu, in the Ituris, and all of the region. And we're ready to surge, indeed, once the finances are there, but once also we have a better access or a role to play in the east of DRC, like many of you have witnessed back in end of August, beginning of September, with a large-scale liberation or transport of over 1,300 military, police, and family members out of Goma into safety in Kinshasa. And that will also continue with our continuous engagement with the mediators, be that in Washington or in Doha. So allow me maybe to stop here for a quick word again on the needs as we see them. I hope this is not a surprise to anyone, but more of a confirmation and an eyewitness of what has been unfortunately ongoing and could only be stopped if a ceasefire is reached and indeed a delivery of assistance to the local population. But more importantly, that the weapon bearers truly respect the sovereignty of every individual, the dignity of every individual, and the protection afforded in the Geneva Conventions. But when we see the numbers on the ground, on the number of women that have been sexually abused, or those who have been shot in the head or in the thorax, and I've seen now myself someone shot in the head, and is a civilian, that is simply unacceptable in this century, and unacceptable to pass without being indeed documented and used indeed as a discussion space and a platform for discussion for these atrocities not to happen anymore. And therefore, that's our message. We are very hopeful, but also very watchful of what the events would entail on the ground, so that our assessments are the most on the spot and not just filmed in the global positivity around the peace process in the East DRC, while again we salute the efforts to put that war into stopping and into a complete halt. A quick word on Sudan. I'll stop there.
Thank you very much, Patrick. A very important, sobering update, I would say. Let's just maybe take questions on DRC, if any, before we move on to Sudan. Colleagues in the room, maybe online. No, I don't see that's the case. You were very comprehensive. So let's perhaps move on to another crisis in the African region. So Sudan.
Sudan, again, we've spoken a couple of days ago on Sudan, and we keep on engaging. Maybe on Sudan, just a word before I forget that the ICRC has just released pictures, photos from the operations in Tawila, which is the one of those hosting grounds for internal displaced fleeing Al-Fashir and the very complex situation. So just a note for our fellow colleagues journalists. So I don't think it's, again, a surprise to know that we've been screaming and shouting for attention on Al-Fashir since a couple of months now. And the situation that has evolved in and around Al-Fashir is indeed very dramatic. The surrounding remains very critical, and we've deployed our teams now for the third time, and a team has been there since the beginning of the month, supporting, in addition to the 55,000 people that received cash. We're in the coming hours tomorrow, I hope we start delivering to 75,000 people some cash assistance, but also other form of assistance. We're hoping that our surgical team that has been deployed now since the second week of November to support Médecins Sans Frontières Center, which lacks traumatology and where we have indeed partnered with that institution in order to boost indeed capacities in that field. You know that our team was in Atbara, that is northeast of the capital Khartoum, and has now migrated to Tawila, close to where the events are occurring. I think in Tawila we've seen that, again, the reports that we get is not huge amounts of IDPs, like millions and millions of people, which we thought would be coming quickly out of Al-Fashir, but also let's be honest, we don't know where they're going, either to Tine, Adre, or Abeche. or indeed inside the country, to Mellit, to Tine in Sudan, or in Tawila. So our teams are scattered really around Al-Fashir, from Al-Janina and Niala to the border with Chad, and we had indeed a very steady program of building up capacities on the border, and we now have a stronger team in Tawila, like we had a couple of days before the eruption of this crisis and the breaking of the siege in there. So we're increasing our support to the essential medical supplies and having more operational assistance to the MSF-supported hospital. We're hoping, obviously, and we have asked very clearly to have access to Al-Fashir, like all other organizations. But indeed, what we need is not just to get in and out. What we need is to have, like we've always said, the right humanitarian space to be able to sit down with the populations, not just deliver assistance and leave. We're not a charity organization, nor is the UN, by the way. What we need is to sit down with people, get their accounts of how much suffering they endured. Again, exactly like we're doing now in Tawila, with people telling our teams that they've come with only a jacket that they're now using to shield themselves from the cold in the night, and making makeshift tents just because they have nothing, as you can imagine, like in every crisis. In this case, these are not civilians who were in Port Sudan or in Khartoum or in Chad. These were under siege for a number of months with no food, no water, no medicine, no diapers, nothing. And they're getting to a place where they're hoping to get more assistance. And yes, the surge is up and running, but indeed the solution is to get into Al-Fashir and make sure by our presence and by our confidential engagement with the parties, meaning the RSF, inside Al-Fashir, that we be able to do our job, that is to protect and assist civilians in the best way possible. Now I have to salute here the huge courage of the Sudanese Red Crescent Society, which has been working on both ends of the front line like the ICRC teams, and have indeed, unfortunately, seen five of their volunteers being killed. That's not a novelty, and that's very unfortunate. Now over 27 volunteers of the Red Crescent have been killed since the beginning of the conflict. Four colleagues from the ICRC, brothers of ours, have also been killed because they were trying to break the front lines and go to the other side and help. And in this case, I just wanted to bring again this salute and a lot of respect to those working in Al-Fashir. You know that before breaking the siege, we were still able to deliver medical assistance to Al Saudi Hospital, the only running hospital. We've been able also to have to engage on community kitchens and work, but that's not, again, just a small drop in the ocean. What we need is to have an all Sudan approach. Don't be fooled. Let's also focus on all of Sudan. Al Fashir is today. Yesterday it was Al Jazeera. Before that it was Omdurman and Khartoum. And therefore we need to have an all Sudan approach and have on both ends of the spectrum the right assistance and protection, like exactly what we and the parties have agreed upon in Jeddah. And I'm sorry to go back always to that framework, which is historical for the Sudanese counterparts, to say they're willing to respect the Geneva Conventions and the basic rules of what customary Sudanese law tell them: no attacks against civilians and against the infrastructure. So that's our hope, really, and we're carrying that message, not just in front of you, but directly with the parties in wherever they are seen and wherever we can indeed engage with them. Maybe a last point is the ICRC is obviously and most certainly engaging with the Quad, meaning the United States, the United Arab Emirates, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and Egypt. And we're seeing indeed that there's a larger engagement around, including the African Union, but maybe other states that would join. And here we can only salute breaking that vicious cycle of war and hoping to get indeed some form of ceasefire, not just for the ceasefire, but for the what it means for allowing more humanitarian aid into a very difficult region. So the ICRC is following up, indeed, with the members of the Quad, is in regular contact with those members, but also with the Sudanese government in Port Sudan and moving into Khartoum, but certainly also with the rapid support forces. So you can see from whatever we can deliver, we will be, and we're hoping to increase as much as possible. I'm sure we we can double our budget for Sudan if we're allowed to act on behalf of the civilian population and in support to Sudanese Red Crescent, but we're not there yet. And hence, we will be able to keep on briefing our donors and engaging with them so that we merge between, we bring some form of bridging between the political process and a donorship that should fall into taking this context out of its forgotten status or neglected status. It's not forgotten. It is neglected completely. And we've said it and repeated now several times. And we're truly hoping that the word peace can be also immediately connected to the respect of civilians, because you respect the civilian, it means you turn that person from a victim to an agent of positive change, and that's what we witness in other contexts, and I'm sure Sudan is no exception. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Patrick. And let me just take this opportunity to echo the salute to your colleague at the Red Crescent and, of course, our colleagues on the ground in this very, very complex theater. And I also draw your attention, of course, colleagues, to the statement that was shared with you last night from Tom Fletcher, the Emergency Relief Coordinator, his comments to journalists yesterday from Audrey Chad, and he's been, as you know, on a visit to the region for the last several days, so very important comments he made yesterday. So over to you for questions, starting with Emma Farge of Reuters.
Good morning. A few questions on Sudan, please. I'm wondering if you have any concerns about a repeat of a siege-like situation that we saw in Al-Fashir for so long in Kordofan. Secondly, do you have much visibility on the situation inside Al-Fashir right now? Obviously, comms are not good, but there are these reports of people being barricaded inside, and can you get any aid to them? And thirdly, since you're in touch with the Quad, do you know what the next steps are in the process? I know there's some meetings in Washington now. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. So I think you're very right to mention what's next. It's Kordofan, as you say, and and the concern is indeed that we witness another horrible scenario whereby we're unable to get into Kordofan. I don't think we're at the same situation in terms of the civilians brought inside in Kordofan are those living in Barra or Kordofan, as opposed to Al-Fashir, which was mainly two huge IDP camps with over, if I'm not mistaken, 500,000 people that have fled from previous wars into there. So yes, the concern is certainly there. And I have to say, I want to compare it to Al Jazeera State. If you recall, every city that changes or is in a transition between an authority and the other would have to witness, unfortunately, a lot of difficulties for the population to cope with the leadership, with the rules, with the impositions, but also with what it entails in terms of arrests and retaliations against the civilian population. So, yes, we're following up on that, and it's one of the major points, so that, again, thinking about preventing further violence, that's on top of our agenda. We do not have, unfortunately, a lot of visibility from inside Al-Fashir. I have to be also very honest that we had teams inside that are we had a person and the teams of the Red Crescent are still operating in Al-Fashir, but we have no visual and we don't know really what's happening. And every day I think is a wasted day without getting access to Al-Fashir, and hence that's why we call now very much every day, but also bilaterally with all those states, including the Quad, to be able to access Al-Fashir as quickly as possible. Next steps for the Quad was indeed what we learned is there were continuous meetings between the parties. There were public accounts of meetings in Washington between the indirectly talking to each other, which gets us out of the premises of what the Alps or what the Jeddah process entailed, meaning entailed and failed in a way, or tried its best but didn't get to that result. So I'm hoping that the next step would be to announce a 3-month ceasefire with the right conditionalities that were mentioned now several times by the parties, indeed with following up on how the parties are responding to these proposals. I think you've seen that from the Sudanese Armed Forces and the government of Sudan, there was a very clear list of conditions for the ceasefire to be accepted and even extended beyond the 3 months par. So we're following up on that, but as the DRC process and our engagement in Doha, our intention is first and foremost for the parties to agree that there are red lines that cannot be transgressed, that cannot be crossed, and that is to inflict more pain on those who have no intention to get into a war or to carry a weapon to protect themselves. If we get into that, a ceasefire is indeed, it could become a formality rather than a necessity today to stop the war. But unfortunately, without a ceasefire, we won't be able to get access, and we tried, as you know, Emma, now for several times to cross when a ceasefire was achieved, and you saw how many people we have lost and how many trucks and assets we have lost along the way. So without firm security guarantees, and again, as I read Mr. Fletcher's account, I hope that this is now done quite quickly, inclusive of Al-Fashir, but also other regions that require the reconstruction or the rehabilitation of human beings and their livelihoods.
Thank you, Patrick. And of course, just to remind your colleagues on the political front, our SG's personal envoy, Ramtane Lamamra, is in regular contact with the authorities in Port Sudan in an effort to advance this genuine Sudanese dialogue aimed towards a lasting peace. So let's take further questions in the room. Inanina from AFP.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for this briefing. I was wondering if you could say a little bit about what you're seeing in the people who are arriving in Tawila and other places where your teams are. What kind of injuries have they suffered? Is there sort of are you seeing systematic use of certain types of abuse? I mean, sexual abuse is what we've been hearing, and other kinds. And then also, in terms of your contact with the RSF, could you say how that contact is proceeding, and if you have any hope that you might actually be able to have a proper access to Al-Fashir? You know, how are those discussions going? Thank you.
Thank you very much for these questions. And first and foremost, I appreciate that an angle, the human angle, is one portrayed on the arrivals rather than just the accounts of what they do. What they endured, following up on their needs is our role. And I think shedding the light on what they witness is certainly your role. And we're really, I think it's important we don't forget those who are voiceless now and have been voiceless for more than a year and now are able to at least express what their needs and what they lived. From the team that went now for several times to Tawila, what we hear is people are getting out without nothing. Is it an imposition? Is it a condition? We really don't know. We're collecting as much allegations from our teams as we usually do. I think the story that stuck in my head, and that was my colleague Jean-Yves telling us that the families are coming with truly zero, with nothing, just walking and getting into Tawila, which, as you know, is in between the RSF and the Sudanese Armed Forces area. They have major needs, namely on nutrition, food and water, but certainly on the medical aspect of things, where the hospital in Al Saudi Hospital had simply the bare minimum of services delivered to the population, but not the whole panoply of services. And as in Tawila with the cholera outbreak, I think the accounts are, unfortunately, those who we hear from every internally displaced in the city. And I'm personally hoping to be in Tawila, but also in Darfur or Khartoum in a couple of weeks, so that we, beyond the trip in itself, we want it to be a culmination of the dialogue we already have, or so that we can indeed establish presence and continue or surge our operations out of Darfur, out of Tawila, and other places. We are indeed in touch with the RSF at all levels, from the field to the command ship, and we are very hopeful that we will get access to Al-Fashir. It is a matter of time, but as my answer to Emma before, to her question, it's every day is a wasted day. We need to get in so that we're witnessing indeed what the civilian population is doing, who are the ones arrested, that they're registered, that they're followed up on, that the people missing, and you know that from Tawila, and I'm sure you've seen our report of the number of phone calls and messages transmitted between family members as part of our usual process of connecting families. I'm sure there are thousands that are incommunicado. We don't know where they are because we simply haven't been able to access those prisoners or detainees. So that's basically what we're negotiating, is not just, again, to get in and out, but truly to be able to sustain a long presence and engage with the populations like we did back in the days in Al-Janina, in Niala, and other parts of Darfur. And North Darfur, where I worked in 2005, I know has specific needs because of the severe malnutrition sometimes the area has, and hence having a comprehensive approach with other UN agencies, with MSF and other organizations is very much needed. But let's also not forget we need to support the local organizations that have stood the test of time in Al-Fashir, where no international organization is present. And therefore, the Sudanese Red Crescent, but also the number of social initiatives that have been there, in my opinion, require urgent support, and that's what we hope to get. But again, I'm very frustrated that not in 24 hours our team were there. The intention is really to be able to do that as quickly as possible.
Thanks again, Patrick. Further questions in the room before we go online? No, okay, in that case, I'll take a question from Nick, New York Times.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for the briefing. I'd like just to follow up a little bit on some of Emma's questions. I appreciate you have no visibility on Al-Fashir, but what is your assessment of how many people are left there now, civilian particularly? And I wondered also, do you have any concerns now for the security of Tawila? What is that a situation that's going to become another combat zone? And also looking at Kordofan, do you have access to Bara and El Obeid? And can you shed any light on the situation in those places? Thank you.
Again, it's impossible to know really the numbers of people who were trapped inside. It's a major concern, and that's why we're still talking about Sudan and exposing ourselves, because we need to have the right access so that we can establish a prism of, or a framework of assessments that allow us to search. I really don't know how many people are on the way to Chad. I know our team is waiting on the other side, but really it's impossible to know how many people are in the city and what kind of needs do they require. That's a city that has been dried up from every humanitarian assistance, from agriculture, livestock have been decimated. So we have to know that between Kutum, between Kapkabiya, between Korma and the north of Darfur, there are millions and millions of people, but also large parts of North Darfur that are just difficult to access in normal times. And then, and hence, it's again very urgent to get there. In Tawila, I personally, and intel from the team says that it's a secured area, and we've spoken to the authorities there about the potential insecurities that could entail a different approach to our humanitarian work. But for now, I think the teams feel safe and have had the security guarantees to operate, so I do not expect that this becomes another front line. Now, the access to Barra or to Al Obeid is challenging but possible, and that's where our teams are currently now pushing to maintain their presence in the areas that have been covered, but also to get access, like in Al Barra, quite quickly. And that's why, in fact, we have deployed the surgical team so that, or parts of the surgical team that assists now the existing hospital, so that we can absorb as much of the humanitarian needs. But again, please note that the intention of the ICRC is not just to come and put a Band-Aid on an infected wound. The intention here is to try and solve the protection crisis that is that the population has been enduring. And by our physical presence, I think we can contribute to that protection, which we've tried and succeeded in many other parts of the world. And again, Sudan shouldn't be an exception in that stance. Now, allow me maybe to go a little bit higher, as I said before, on the macro issues pertaining to the war in the whole of the country. And therefore, looking wherever we look, there are humanitarian needs. As you yourself covered Al Jazeera, Omdurman, Khartoum, I think these are episodes that would have to push us to have a comprehensive approach of what our agencies are able to deliver, but also what the parties to the conflict themselves can do to minimize risk and harm on the civilian population. And that hasn't been working, to be honest, especially with the consistent and systematic attacks against the infrastructure, which led that 70% of the medical facilities have been out of order, to put it as bluntly as simply.
Thank you very much. Again, Patrick, maybe just to recite again what Mr. Fletcher mentioned yesterday in terms of, we have no visibility of how many people are in Al Fasher, but he did note since 26 October, that is the latest upsurge of violence, more than 100,000 people have been displaced from Al Fasher to the surrounding villages. So that's just a one very grim statistic. So let's take further questions, starting going back online, rather, with John Zarakostas, Franz von Katt.
Can you hear me there, Patrick? Hello?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Yes, good morning. Yes, Patrick, I was wondering if you could bring us up to speed on the situation with severe acute malnutrition in Tawila and other areas. We've heard some horrific numbers on children suffering from severe acute malnutrition. What is the ICRC doing, and also other agencies listening in on the briefing, like World Food Program, WHO, or OCHA? What can they tell us? What is being done right now? And also, knowing your beat is all of Africa, there was also an alert of IPC5 also for South Sudan.
Okay. Well, again, as I said, we are. This war hasn't started yesterday, and the siege has led to severe malnutrition to a point where the UN had announced indeed a famine declaration on Al Fasher. So they naturally would be witnessing severe malnutrition for kids, and that's what MSF and WFP have been working on. I don't have all the details, but I know that they have these capacities and they're working on that situation. That's why we teamed up with an existing structure rather than waste time and open a new structure in Tawila or support another structure. So, coalescing our own efforts together will help us. Now, our team on the ground have seen that the best approach is to support with cash assistance, which then allows the economy to work, and it's the easiest way to achieve a result in this case. I'm sure there are specific cases of severe malnutrition that MSF has, but I don't have the figures. And therefore, if in our assessment and as we speak, we will get into that, I'm sure the Red Crescent Society of Sudan has the capacity with the support of the ICRC. Please also note that there's a large, more than a handful of participating national societies, meaning other countries have sent their own Red Cross or Red Crescent societies to Sudan and are happy and willing to support. And we're leaning on their own capacities in this world of financial contraction to be able, as a Red Cross, Red Crescent movement, to work together on finding solutions. On South Sudan, I don't have the latest figures, and I don't know if you're referring to specific pockets in Renk in the northwest or the northeast, but we'll follow up on that for sure. Now, know that the teams are spread across South Sudan, and I've been following indeed the influx or the return of South Sudanese returnees. And whatever the situation will be, we have a much better access and with less security concerns to be able to respond quickly. But let me then focus on your question and your assessment, and we'll get back to you, John, as quickly as possible. But I don't know where exactly that pocket had been identified. But I'm sure it's not the whole country, nor it's the whole of North, neither in the Equatorias for that region as a general term, but I'll follow up on that for sure.
Thanks very much. And colleagues, just to maybe illustrate the complexity of this conflict, we have South Sudanese refugees in Sudan, of which have been displaced. It's just an absolutely horrific situation in the whole region. So thanks very much for those questions. I think that exhausts the questions on Sudan. So I'd like to thank you very, very much, Patrick. It's always a pleasure to have you here. Hopefully you can come back with some good news, better news, let's hope. And thank you again very much. Okay, we're going to shift. Ricardo, if I can call you up here. While Ricardo makes his way up, maybe colleagues, if I may just refer to a statement which you will have seen this morning. It's actually a note to correspondents from our spokesperson in New York on behalf of the Secretary General concerning the adoption of the resolution on Gaza by the Security Council. Again, we shared this with you moments ago, and it notes that this adoption is an important step in the consolidation of the ceasefire, which the Secretary General encourages all parties to abide by. So there's more in that statement, which we shared with you about a half hour ago. Without further ado, over to you, Ricardo, and thank you very much for this update on Gaza. Over to you.
Thank you, Rolando. Good morning. Bonjour. As the attentions, as you said, Rolando, are focused on the diplomatic developments that took place yesterday, the situation of children and families in Gaza remains catastrophic, extremely dire, with the temperatures changing and the weather creating a lot of difficulties to an already exhausted population. Severe rain and floodings have deepened the suffering of children and families in Gaza, particularly for internally displaced families living in makeshift shelters. An estimated 17,000 families have been affected over the last 3 or 4 days. We are seeing heartbreaking stories of desperate families feeling completely lost and exhausted after their tents got flooded. Most of them have been displaced multiple times and lost everything in the past 2 years, their possessions, their homes, loved ones. When children are sleeping in flooded tents without warm clothing or dry bedding, many lacking the required nutrition, with very low immunity, and already traumatized by conflict, winter becomes extremely dangerous. It can lead to hypothermia, respiratory infections, and preventable deaths. Because of the current division of the Gaza Strip, with Israeli forces occupying more than 50% of the territory, many of the areas where Palestinians were forced to go run along the coast and are also the most flood-prone. UNICEF and partners rapidly scaled up assistance as we could, reaching 8,800 families within 72 hours. Despite large-scale deliveries, since the ceasefire, stocks are now depleting and can only support an additional 7,500 families in the coming days, and the weather is expected again to worsen, and impact will be very, very similar, if not worse, to what we're seeing right now in Gaza. In terms of latest response and supplies, since the ceasefire up to 17th November, UNICEF has brought 5,000 family tents, 237,000 tarpaulins, 500,000 blankets, that's 500,000 blankets for children and families across the strip, 45,000 mattresses, and 122,000 sets of winter clothes into Gaza. But severe weather risks are expected again to continue in the weeks ahead, leaving families without safe shelter, clean water, and warm clothing, exposed to heightened health protection and safety risks. to sustain and scale the response, more resources, predictable access, and a steady, unhindered supply pipeline through all humanitarian corridors are urgently needed. So we're calling again for more humanitarian aid to get in. As we can see, the weather is just another element, an important, dangerous element right now for children. But the situation with nutrition, access to clean water, again, shelter and access to health care remains very, very dire. So we're very optimistic that the peace plans will improve the situation. But again, the reality for children on the ground continues to be very tragic. Thank you, Rolando.
Thanks to you, Ricardo. Okay, let's take questions in the room. Jeremy, Edifi.
Thank you, Rolando. Several questions here. On the figures, I think you mentioned 17,000 families. Can you give us what does it mean in terms of total population, 17,000 families, if we think that's a 2, 3, 4 person per household? So basically, how many people? Like to understand also what is lacking right now. You mean like obviously humanitarian aid, but is there any specific, you mean, is it tents? Because the tents are flooded right now. So do you need something special that you cannot get into the Gaza Strip right now? And also, basically, when I hear what you're saying is that there is no improvement since last winter. So does it mean that ceasefire or no ceasefire, it doesn't make any difference when it comes to housing and living conditions for the people in the Gaza Strip during winter time?
Yeah, thank you for your questions. In terms of the consolidated number of people impacted, we don't have a figure. We know 17,000 families, an average of 4 or 5 people per family, perhaps. We can try and do the maths, but we don't, again, have a number of people impacted because that level of assessment hasn't been possible. Also due to the difficulty in reaching out to these areas that have been flooded and are severely impacted and again at risk. In terms of what has improved, I mean, obviously since the ceasefire, we've managed to get a lot more tents in, tarpaulins, winter clothes, blankets, coats for children, clothing, and this makes a difference, which last year was not as prominent in terms of quantity crossing inside the Gaza Strip. So obviously, because we have now 3 humanitarian crossings open and functioning at different speeds and levels of inspection and therefore quantity of aid getting in, we're managing to respond a lot better than we did last year. But again, when it comes to climatic shocks and severe weather, sometimes even when you are pre-positioned and you have a lot of supplies ready to go, it doesn't come out as positively as you would expect. And again, after 2 years of war and wide destruction in Gaza, families have been living in tents that many of them are not waterproofs or waterproof, or that have been deteriorated over the past year or so because of the horrible conditions they have been living in, and because of also conflict that has only recently stopped. So not every family or every person in Gaza is living in a tent. Lots of people try to go back to whatever is left to their homes in the center areas or in the northern part of Gaza, and they're also exposed to weather and severe storms and flooding and cold temperatures. So we can reach out to them. They don't need tents, but they do need blankets. They do need warm clothing. They do need medicines in case their children get sick because of the cold temperatures. So again, to answer to your question more directly, the ceasefire has made a difference. We are managing to get more in, but it's not enough. It's the same thing we've been saying about this crisis for so long. Whatever aid we get in is not necessarily a drop in the ocean anymore, but it's definitely not responding and addressing the scale and the level of deprivation and destruction and needs that have been unfolding for the last 2 years.
Thanks very much. Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
Quick one. When you said that most of the tents, I don't know if you said most of, but you're saying that the tents are not waterproof. technically speaking, when you manage to get tents into the Gaza Strip, are they waterproof or are they not? Like, how many of them are actually made to resist water?
Sorry. I think most of the tents are waterproof. I can speak for UNICEF. The quality of the tents that we deploy and get into the Gaza Strip can endure weather, but again, severe weather is very different than the average rain. So even the best quality tents that are waterproof might not sustain the level of deprivation and destruction and the horrible conditions on the ground. The tarpaulins are not necessarily waterproof, and they have been used also to build shelter, right? So again, when you have strong storms coming in, and I'm not a weather expert, but I can speak from what I hear colleagues sharing on the ground. The conditions of those tents, because of the winds and because of the multiple displacements and having to build and rebuild their temporary shelters for so long, they just deplete. The quality goes down, as with any, I guess, commodity as such, and therefore the need to replace them is very urgent. And when it comes to the tents, even the waterproof ones will not endure 2-3 years of, you know, repeated conditions, severe weather conditions.
Thanks. Nina.
Yeah, thanks, Ricardo. I was wondering, you're talking about more materials coming in for tents in winter, but what about building materials? Is that something that you're seeing coming in? Because, I mean, people are trying to rebuild structures, I assume, and that's pretty important, and especially with the decision yesterday to bring in aid at scale, are you hopeful that that is one of the issues, I mean, one of the items that will be brought in? That was one question. And then I also had a question on, you were talking about the dangers for children when that are suffering this situation. Have you already seen, are there already children who are freezing to death, or are, if you could sort of give us more insight into that. Thank you.
Thank you. In terms of construction materials, that's not something UNICEF has brought into Gaza. We do bring essential parts and equipment to repair water infrastructure, for example, which has been a challenging exercise for us in terms of getting it through inspections and Israeli approvals. Some of these parts are not considered single use, so they're considered again the dual use and not allowed in, and we have to advocate strongly for them to cross into Gaza so we can start repairing water pumps and other water infrastructure. So in terms of water and sanitation, yes, UNICEF has been bringing parts in and will continue to advocate for that. But in terms of construction of building and clearance of rubble, I don't think we're the best position to answer that question. As far as the new developments and the UN Security Council resolution and increasing access of aid, absolutely, that's something that we will call for. It is part of the deal, and we need to see more humanitarian corridors open. We need to see more quantity of aid getting in, more trucks, more corridors, again, more access. We have Zikim open now, and just recently UNICEF managed to get 96 pallets of high-energy biscuits to go to the north of Gaza, which is a positive development. But again, 96 pallets to respond to the needs of over 2 years of deprivation, it's not enough. Repeating the same sentence again, we need more, a lot more, and hopefully with the new plan, that will become a reality for children and families.
And this is explicitly mentioned in the statement which I referred to yesterday, among other things, you know, saying what we've been repeating here for nearly 25 months now, that we do need humanitarian assistance. We need it at scale. This diplomatic momentum must translate into something lasting. And this is explicitly mentioned in the SG's message. Of course, you know, the onus is on the colleagues, to fulfill the need to transform this not into, you know, something theoretical right now, but it has to be lasting. And this is something that that the SG has been saying since day one. So humanitarian assistance at scale, supporting all efforts to move the parties towards the next phase of the ceasefire as well. Nina, you had a follow-up?
Yeah, I just wanted to follow up on the last part of my question, which was on the children and the in terms of the cold that they're suffering, and if you have seen what you've seen in terms of impacts on them. If there are kids who have frozen to death, or if they're, what kind of injuries they're suffering. Thanks.
Gladly, so far we haven't received any reports of children dying of hypothermia or cold. However, we are seeing the needs increasing in terms of medical care because of severe weather events recently, and how because their immunities are so low after 2 years of malnutrition, starvation, trauma, multiple displacements, they're much less prepared to handle any shift in conditions on the ground, including with their health. So we do know that children are requiring more medical attention because of the severe weather events that have happened recently. But I don't have specifics in terms of number of children who've been admitted or have been screened for any particular illness related to climatic shocks or severe events.
Thank you very much. And maybe going back to your previous question on construction, we'll definitely try to get some answers for you on what, if any, is earmarked to move in on construction needs. We have heard from colleagues who addressed this issue in the past, but we'll get an update for you. Emma.
I had one question on supplies, kind of a follow-up to Jeremy's, but then also one more general question on the U.S. Resolution that was passed yesterday. And I don't know if other colleagues, maybe Acha might also be able to weigh in on that one. But on the ceasefire supplies running out, as you mentioned, I'm just wondering why it is that the opening of the new crossing in the north hasn't helped more. I'd heard some rumors that maybe it was only half open one day, but not the next. I was just wondering if that was part of the problem on supplies. Maybe we do that one, and then I'll go to the more general one.
Yeah, I've heard similar. Emma, I think the Zikim opening is, again, very welcome and positive news. We need more humanitarian crossings open, as I mentioned before. From what I understand from colleagues on the ground, this is not a one-off, and nor it is partially operating. We managed to get these 96 pallets of high-energy biscuits relatively quickly. They were collected yesterday, and now UNICEF will pick them up inside Gaza and take them to our to the communities in need, to our beneficiaries. We are expecting a continuous flow of supplies in Zikim, so I don't have any information that defers to that. So again, we're hopeful that this will be another positive development as we move forward with a more sustainable plan to rebuild Gaza and take civilians and children out of this constant suffering.
Thank you very much. I don't know if Jens has anything to add, but again, if you wanted to join me here, of course, Jens. Again, the idea is to turn this decision that we were referred to earlier into concrete action through all the various ways and means that we've been hearing from colleagues talking about in their messaging. But maybe Jens has something to add.
Could you just repeat the question? I'm not sure.
Yeah, sorry. I didn't actually ask it yet. So here we go. And I appreciate you sharing the statement, Ricardo. It's dated yesterday, so it's just a bit difficult to use. So I'd be really grateful if other agencies could just react to the decision to pass the U.S. drafted resolution. Is this a step closer to helping Gazans rebuild their lives? And also, China and Russia abstained because they said it didn't have a clear enough role for the U.N. Do you share that sentiment? Thank you.
We will echo what the Secretary General has said. Obviously, we will do that. We are part of the UN Secretariat. So that is what we have to say for now, at least, on that. We're still, as you all know, in the hypotheticals. It's a decision that is made in the Security Council. Now it needs some meat on the bones. On this, but there was a clear welcome from the Secretary General.
Yep, Ricardo.
I can add something, Emma. We just reiterate that any new plan or framework should really put children at the very center of it, in line, of course, with the humanitarian principles of humanity, neutrality, impartiality, and independence, which are non-negotiable for UNICEF and for the UN. Children represent half of the population in Gaza and hold the greatest potential to rebuild a peaceful, healthy, and thriving society, but nonetheless, they remain the most vulnerable to the ongoing instability, deprivation, disease, and displacement, as I've mentioned just now and in my previous points. For more than 2 years, they have suffered the highest levels of physical harm and psychological trauma. So ensuring that their safety, education, healthcare, mental well-being, and family unity is not only a legal and moral imperative, it's actually a practical investment in long-term stability and recovery for Gaza. So a plan that prioritizes children lays the foundation for lasting peace, dignity, and opportunity for people in Gaza.
Thank you both very much. John Zarakostas?
Yes, I'm coming back to my earlier question, and if concerning severe acute malnutrition in the Darfur region, and if Christian from WHO or Jens from OCHA or Jean-Martin from World Food Programme or Ricardo could bring us up to date what is being done to help this, according to some children's NGOs, very high numbers of severe acute malnutrition in the region. Thank you.
Maybe we can, Tarek is connected, there he is and his hand is up. Look at that. So, Tarek, over to you. Thanks for joining.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, John. And I was just sending you by email as I wasn't quick enough to raise my hand when we talked about Sudan. So what I have really here is that since the start of the conflict, there was a surge in acute malnutrition. And in 2025, 3.7 million people are in need of nutrition response. Now, colleagues from UNICEF estimate that 770,000 children under 5 years will suffer from severe acute malnutrition in 2025. The figure I have is that between January 1st and October 31st this year, 36,243 children have been admitted to stabilization centers for the treatment of severe acute malnutrition with medical complications. Now, WHO is providing technical support and supplies for 143 operational stabilization centers in 2025 for the management of severely acute malnutrition children with medical complications, helping to treat those 36,000 243 that I just mentioned. There are also like 47 out of those 143 stabilization centers are getting support from WHO, not only technical but also operational support, including running costs, staff incentives, and hygiene supplies. I already sent you, John, all these details so you'll have the figures.
Thanks, Tarek. And colleagues, let me remind you that Jean-Martin Bauer, our colleague from WFP, is online. He's going to be briefing next on global outlook on food security, and maybe he can chime in on this point. I don't know if, Jens, did you have something to add on the previous questions?
No, just John, if I understood correctly, you were asking about malnutrition in El Fasha. Was that the question?
John?
Yeah, El Fasha is the, not only El Fasha, other parts of the Darfur as well.
Okay, I just heard El Fasha. It's, of course, it's a valid question, but as we also just heard from our Red Cross colleagues, we don't even know how many people are in El Fasha. So what we need first is to get access. And as you have seen from Emergency Relief Coordinator Fletcher's briefing yesterday, that is what he has been working on very hard. And he got some assurances, both from both sides of the conflict, that is clear significant progress towards access. It's not there yet, but that's what he has been working on. At the same time, we have been searching more people into Darfur as a whole for the purpose of being ready once that access is there, but of course also respond to the needs across that entire region.
Thank you very much, Jens. I'm sorry, colleague, I know we're moving around different subjects here, but all very, very important subjects indeed. So I think that concludes Gaza, Sudan. We do have, thank you very much, Ricardo and Jens, of course. And as I mentioned, Jean-Martin Bauer, who's the director of WFP's Food Security and Nutritional Analysis Service, is joining us from Rome, and we're very pleased to have you with us, Jean-Martin. 2026 Global Outlook on Food Security. So over to you.
Thank you. What I'd like to do today is walk you through the Global Outlook of 2026. This really captures our latest analysis and what needs to be done to respond to global acute food insecurity worldwide. So our analysis shows that 318 million people worldwide are facing acute food insecurity. That's a number, to put it into perspective, that's double the number that existed in 2019 before the pandemic. We're at a plateau of very high need worldwide and also a very severe need. For the first time this century, we have two famines at the same time, one taking place in Gaza and the other one in parts of Sudan, as my colleagues mentioned earlier on. This is unprecedented. And the problem that we lay out in this global outlook is that the world's response remains slow, fragmented, and underfunded. We have drastic funding cuts impeding WFP operations. Almost every single operation of WFP has been facing steep reductions in rations or in beneficiaries, in food provided, in cash provided to people who are very vulnerable. We're also prioritizing people who need help. Now, at the same time that the humanitarian resources are becoming scarcer, we're also facing attacks on our colleagues. And that's revealing a growing disregard for international humanitarian law. So aid workers are not a target. These funding cuts are having an impact on people already. We believe that the impacts of these funding cuts will translate into increased food insecurity worldwide. We estimate that approximately 14 million people will move from crisis to emergency levels of hunger as a result of the cuts to international assistance. Now, this is a somber reality, we're still determined to continue changing lives, to continue doing our very best on the ground. And what we're appealing for in 2026 is an operational requirement of $13 billion US dollars to assist 110 million people with life-saving and life-changing support. All these figures were determined with a rigorous analysis. We'll be getting there by leveraging innovation, by leveraging things we do very well, such as digital cash transfers. We'll be leveraging our AI tools to find efficiencies in our supply chain, to reduce costs and reach people faster, even in the world's most complex environments. In closing, what I'd like to do is remind you that food assistance, it's more than life-saving relief. It's stability, it's dignity, it's hope. And we need to continue our commitment to ending hunger worldwide. Back to you in the room.
Thank you very much, Jean-Martin. And as you referred to, we had this meeting at the Security Council yesterday on food insecurity. At that meeting, the Deputy Secretary General Amina Mohammed emphasized that war and hunger are intertwined, with starvation increasingly used as a weapon. She noted that while global military spending reached $21.9 trillion over the past decade, ending hunger by 2030 would cost $93 billion. Now, that is, I just did the math, and that's less than 1%, which is really puts things into perspective. So very important. And of course, she noted what Mr. Bauer just noted about having two famines, which is unprecedented. So do take a look at those statements as well. So thank you very much, Jean-Martin. We have a question from Jean Zarakostas of France 24.
Yes, thanks, Jean-Martin. Can you elaborate a little bit this estimate of more than 40 million people were moved from crisis to emergency levels? Are we talking people moving into IPC4? And what is the risk of people falling into IPC5? I think last week there was an alert for six countries, including Haiti, Mali, Sudan, South Sudan, Gaza, and also Yemen. So can you break down a bit of this crisis shifting to emergency, and where are the worst situations around the world? Thank you.
Thank you, John. Now, exactly what's going on is that we estimate that almost 14 million people will move from IPC3 to IPC4. So that's from crisis to emergency. We use the international scale, the international reference for food security analysis and the numbers we provide. So that's the framework used by the integrated food security phase classification, phase one being normal, phase two stress, phase three crisis, phase four emergency, and phase five catastrophe. And if enough evidence is there for people in phase five, then that's a confirmed famine. So what we're telling you today is that the funding cuts that are taking place are going to push 14 million people from phase three crisis to phase four emergency. They're very clear, because people fall below a specific threshold of kilocalories, and that means they're that much more vulnerable. To be very clear with you, you have about 40 million people at baseline in category four emergency. And what we're telling you today is that these funding cuts would push people, 14 million of them, into phase four. That would be almost a 30% increase in the level of people in phase four. What WFP is telling you is that to avoid this, we're going to need $13 billion to help 110 million people worldwide. Now, your question is about the most severe cases, the people in category five in IPC phase five. And as you mentioned, there are a group of countries that are at risk. These countries include Sudan, Palestine, South Sudan, Haiti, Mali, and Yemen. These are countries that either already have people in phase five that are already facing famine conditions, or that have a risk of falling into that category of extreme food insecurity. We also have our eye on other conditions, situations in the world. We're very concerned about what goes on in Afghanistan, in the Democratic Republic of Congo, Myanmar, Nigeria, Somalia, and Syria for different reasons. So the fact is, the number of people in category five has increased tremendously in the past few years as a result of conflict and as a result of reduced access for humanitarians. We need to work on that in order to avoid the worst.
Thank you very much. In the room, Emma, Reuters.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for this briefing. I'm wondering if you're thinking about changes to your funding model, given how grave the funding situation is. Obviously, the needs are getting bigger, but the money's just not there. Could you maybe think about cutting your budgets down to more realistic levels, or perhaps get some rich individuals to contribute more? How are you thinking about these issues going forward? And secondly, I'm just wondering if you had any response to the U.S. government withholding food aid, the SNAP system. Could the U.S. ever become a situation of concern for WFP, maybe even a beneficiary? Thank you.
So Emma, the answer to what we're doing to address the resource shortfall, the answer is all of the above. We are looking at all possible donors. We are talking to everybody in order to increase our resource base. And we've also reviewed our appeals. So if you compare the numbers I gave you today I'm telling you we need for 2026, $13 billion to help 110 million people. Last year, we had higher numbers. We asked for $16.9 billion to help 123 million people this year. Now, the appeal for 2026 is smaller. It's smaller not because of reduced need. In fact, the needs are still very high. They're still very, very concerning. But we've reduced the need to be as realistic as possible. And we've prioritized the most vulnerable in what we do. And these are very difficult decisions. In some cases, it's really a taking from the hungry to feed the starving. We shouldn't be in that position at all. The question on the U.S. and SNAP, I think, is not for me to answer. Back to the room.
Thanks very much. Nina, AFP.
Thank you very much for the briefing. I wanted to clarify some of the numbers a little bit, because I saw that you had a joint report with the FAO last week when you were talking about that only $10.5 billion had been received so far of a required $29 billion to help those in need. I guess that was the joint appeal for 2025. It was a little unclear. How does that compare to today's report? And then, if I understand correctly from what you're saying today, WFP is now saying you're going to help only a third of those you know who are in need, and you expect that you'll only get half of the amount you need to help them properly, that third. Is that accurate? And finally, I was just wondering if you could give us some examples of what you're expecting to see. I mean, you've mentioned these areas with famine and very high levels of concern. Are we expecting to see mass hunger from this system where there's not enough money to fund? Thank you.
No, thank you, Emma. Those are great questions, and thank you for following our work so closely. The report last week you mentioned, it was the FAO WFP report on the hunger hotspots, which identified countries of concern. It mentioned a funding figure, but that was for the overall humanitarian food sector. What I'm telling you today, the numbers I have for you today are about WFP specifically and about the needs we have, the urgent needs we have for our own response. So, and the numbers I mentioned, so $13 billion for 110 million people, that's for 2026. I hope that that's clear. The number for 2025 for WFP was $16.9 billion for 123 million people. I hope that's really clear on where we're at with the numbers. As you say, what this means is that we're saying that there are 318 million people in acute food insecurity worldwide. We will be proposing a plan of action to support about one third. That does leave a gap, and there are questions about how prioritization takes place and how we make sure that we focus our resources on the most vulnerable. But that's exactly what we're going to be doing with our data tools, with our partners, to ensure the resources target those who need them most. Now, what we're expecting in some of these countries is quite harrowing. The research that we've done in the past few years shows that there's an intimate link between conflict and hunger, and that there's a link between increased food insecurity and migration. And we're seeing some worrying trends already. My colleagues in Afghanistan, for instance, where the coverage of food programs has reduced quite substantially, that's having impacts on people. They're telling me that 9 out of 10 women who turn up to nutrition centers in Afghanistan are being turned away without food. They're coming, sometimes walking for a very long time with their children in the hope of receiving a ration for their young child, and they're being turned away. This is what the situation means. This is what this lack of resources entails. Its impact on individuals who are very vulnerable, quite often women, children, displaced people. Their impact on stability for countries that aspire to stability, and there could be an impact at the regional level for countries that have nothing to do with this problem, but who are exposed to the consequences of out of control hunger in a country nearby.
Thanks. That's very clear. Thank you very much, Jean-Martin. I think that concludes. And of course, if you can share your notes, that would be very helpful as well. I think yeah, that does it for questions. So thank you once again. It's always a pleasure to have you join us here, and please do so in the near future. Okay, colleagues, we have Anne on the call from the Global Fund, and thank you very much for your patience. Anne has an update from the Global Fund, 8th Replenishment Summit. Anne, over to you.
Indeed, and good morning, everyone. It's quite difficult to actually speak after the colleagues in those very difficult topics. We are in the home run to our 8th Replenishment Summit. It's taking place on Friday in the margins of the G20 Summit in Johannesburg, and it's co-hosted by the United Kingdom and South Africa. It's, of course, a very important moment for us for the fight against the three diseases, against HIV, AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria. We hope to secure investments that we will need to expand these life-saving programs in over 120 countries, mainly Africa and Asia, from 2026 to 2028, so for the next 3 years, basically. So why does this matter? Well, because it's a pivotal moment to accelerate the fight against the three diseases, to strengthen health systems. And it's also, frankly, a test of global solidarity at a time when health budgets have been shrinking and fragile gains are at risk. So I'll give you a quick snapshot. I know we're under pressure, but a very quick one of the fragile progress made so far, but also of the transformative opportunities ahead. Well, for TB, for instance, the global TB report was released last week, and we know that we're finally declining. Deaths are declining. Again, first time since the COVID-19 pandemic. We have AI-powered diagnostics that help detect cases faster and more accurately, even in remote settings, in conflict settings, and the settings that my colleagues Patrick and Ricardo were talking about. We can save more lives. When it comes to HIV, we have prevention tools that are advancing at a very rapid pace, especially with lenacapavir. You might have heard about it. It's a long-acting injectable that you can give just twice a year, and it's almost effective at 100%. And it could basically transform prevention, especially for young women and girls who are still those who are most affected by HIV/AIDS, by removing the daily burden of pills, by giving something that's more discreet, more easy, basically not to show to society. And thanks to an access agreement that we made a few months ago, this basic life-saving tool could already become a lifeline in low and middle-income countries at the same time as in high-income countries. That's a historic moment in the very near future. For malaria, we're facing a perfect storm. Climate shocks, conflict. My colleagues have just talked about it, rising drug resistance. But with funding and innovation, we can scale next-generation mosquito nets, we can scale vaccines, and recently there's even been a new malaria therapy. It was announced last week, and it gives fresh hope against drug-resistant strains. So there are innovative breakthroughs on the table, but they must be seeded, they must be scaled in an equitable manner, and of course they must be funded. So we're really at a crossroads here. So in a nutshell, Friday's summit is not just about financing programs, it's about delivering on the promise of health and well-being for all. It's about transforming societies, and it's about ensuring that future generations, our kids potentially, only know AIDS, TB, and malaria as diseases we have overcome. Some of you colleagues in Johannesburg will attend in person, and if you'd like to join virtually, let me know and I'll send you the registration. And if you have questions, of course, you know where to find me.
Thanks so much, Anne. Thank you very, very much, and I'm sure colleagues will be reaching out to you for that link and additional material. So good luck for this summit. This is Friday. Do we have questions for Anne? No, I think you are very clear. So thank you again, and good luck to you this coming week. Okay, colleagues, nearly done. Just wanted to flag a few things as usual. Just wanted to make certain you've seen the statement we shared with you last night after hours, which is to announce the appointment of Mr. Alexander De Croo of Belgium as the administrator of the United Nations Development Program. and his nomination was confirmed by the General Assembly yesterday. We shared with you a statement to that effect, noting that, of course, Mr. De Croo succeeds Mr. Steiner, Achim Steiner of Germany, and whom the Secretary General is grateful for his leadership and commitment. And the SG also expressed his appreciation to Heilong Su, who is the associate administrator of UNDP, who has been and will continue to serve as the acting administrator until Mr. De Croo assumes his position. He has, Mr. De Croo has an impressive resume, which is contained in the statement we shared with you last night, so we'd encourage you to read that. I have a press conference to announce this coming Tuesday, the 25th of November, World AIDS Day 2025. Subject is Overcoming Disruption, Transforming the AIDS Response, the title for this year's report. The executive director, Winnie Byanyima, will be here to speak with you in this room at 2 p.m. on the 25th of November at a press conference. Meetings, as Alessandra mentioned, we have the Committee Against Torture, which is still underway. This morning, it's the review of Bahrain taking place at the Committee Against Torture and the Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, CERD, kicked off yesterday during a session during which several country reports will be reviewed: Maldives, Guatemala, Sweden, Burundi, New Zealand, Tunisia. And today, or this afternoon rather, it's Maldives. I also want to give you a heads up, colleagues. This afternoon, there is the release of a report, the World Urbanization Prospects 2025 report, from our colleagues at DESA, the Department of Economic and Social Affairs. If you're interested, we can share that report with you under embargo for 6:45 our time today. As I mentioned earlier, the Young Activist Summit is taking place this week, this Thursday, the 20th. It's a great event. If you could show up in the Assembly Hall, it's from 10 to 12 on Thursday. Five young activists from Cote d'Ivoire, India, Lebanon, Brazil, Japan, speaking to very, very interesting achievements that they've made to drive positive change in their countries and in the region. Ages between 17 and 27, so definitely very impressive youngsters who will be speaking. We have also others who will be addressing the this important event on Thursday. And I just wanted to flag that tomorrow is World Toilet Day, the 19th of November, which is actually a theme that will be addressed by some of the laureates. Clean water. Sanitation, immensely important, and this is something which UNICEF, of course, providing these figures. Contaminated water can spread diarrheal diseases, which kill over 1,000 children a day. Think about that, 1,000 children a day. That's about, I don't know how many jumbo jets crashing. Doesn't quite make the headlines, but this is a stark statistic which I think we need to be reminded of. Water, sanitation. This is a central message for World Toilet Day tomorrow, and in fact, one of our colleagues, our young man from India, is dealing with water sanitation in India, and he'll be speaking about that at the YAS this Thursday. That's it from me. Any questions? No, in that case, have a good afternoon, and see you here on Friday. Thanks.